and hope that you will be my friend when we're done. A lot of what I'm going to say is probably not terribly popular, and at first blush, I may say some things that you don't agree with, and I certainly am going to say some things that a lot of folk don't agree with. And some of the people who would challenge a part of what I'm going to say are really extremely prominent. I'm not talking about within our brotherhood necessarily, but people who have written and talked on the subject that I am about. And I'm not going to call myself diametrically opposed to them, but I am going to say that I am pretty uncomfortable with some pretty well accepted positions about race and unity within the church. And so, this may be boring as all get out. And on the other hand, it could be fun. If controversy is fun, then maybe we can have some fun. What I want to try to do, talking about racial reconciliation, is basically define some issues. And the reason I think they need defining is simply because, though they appear to me to be as obvious as anything could be, there are things that we have pretty well ignored about race and the need for racial unity in our brotherhood. So I want to try to define the issues, not necessarily to propose any solutions. And here's the why that I'm not proposing solutions. It is because I trust us. I like us a lot. I'm talking about we Church of Christ people, us Church of Christ folk. I like us. And I do trust us. And what I mean by that is I think that if the issues are clearly defined, that we have sufficient commitment, we are sufficiently spiritual people, we are sufficiently convinced that we must do the right thing, that given clarity, we will find solutions to problems. And maybe I've just chosen to believe that about us. Sometimes, frankly, the evidence about us is not terribly good. I have chosen to believe that we are a people of genuine devotion to God and to principle, and that given the right thing, we'll do it. So if I can define the issues, then I trust you to find the solutions. And that's where I want to go today. I do think in regard to racial reconciliation, race relationships in our brotherhood, that there are some issues of what I consider the very greatest importance that are unresolved. And today I'm going to talk about black and white relationships specifically, recognizing that there are a lot of issues beyond that. The church that I work with, and I work with an inner city congregation in downtown Houston, have been a member of that congregation and a minister there for 11 years now. We started the church in January of 1987, and it's the only place that I'm a member of a congregation. And we are certainly a unique church in our brotherhood. There are a few others that bear some similarities to it, but we're not like any church that most people have seen before. We are about 500 people strong. That's people that regularly attend there. Now, we won't normally have a full 500 on Sunday. Last Sunday, we had, I think, about 450 people at the combined services. But we're about a third white, a third black, and a third Hispanic. We've got one Asian. the population of the city of Houston is the demographics there are changing. Excuse my voice, are changing so rapidly, and the fastest growing in terms of percentage, the fastest growing group numerically is Hispanics. But there's already a million plus Hispanics there, and so the percentage growth is not as great. The numerical growth is unbelievable. But the group that's growing the most rapidly in terms of percentage is Asian. Asian Americans. A lot are becoming American. But there are 117,000, the number I got from the Houston Library recently, 117,000 Asians in our city. And again, just growing amazingly rapidly. But I want to talk specifically about the black and white relationships. And the reason I want to do that is because I think it's a great starting place. and that it's where the issues tend for most of us, because we tend to be a white brotherhood, and we have dealt with the racial segregation of this nation all of our lives, and so it tends to be the area where the greatest problems occur, and at least the most immediate ones that have to be dealt with occur. And so I want to talk basically today about black and white relationships. Toward the end, I'd like to finish. And what time are we supposed to be finished? I really forget. 9:30. We get to go all the way to 9:30. I'd like to say some things, and then toward the end, let us all talk. And Brother Taylor from Oklahoma had some questions a moment ago. And not necessarily for me, because I don't have answers to most questions. We're raising questions at this point. But he's dealing with Vietnamese influx into his city, and they're changing one street from
Military Avenue is going to become Saigon Boulevard.
Yeah, Military Avenue is going to become Saigon Boulevard. And, you know,
City Council approving.
Sure, and we've got to decide how to respond to those kinds of things. Or is that positive or negative? And there are people who say yes, it is. Yes, sir.
Our preacher's wife is from there.
From Vietnam?
Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I'd love for us at the end to have some time to talk about that. But let me again, because it's a starting place, let me talk about white and black relationships, specifically in the churches of Christ. Some unresolved issues. Number one, we live in a racially segregated world. Inside and outside the church, we tend to segregate ourselves racially. We are, in fact, two brotherhoods. And we're going to talk about whether that's defensible or not. And I'll tell you up front, my position is that it is not. Our churches are either black or white, with some rare exceptions. I suspect that some of you attend churches that are experiencing some integration, but basically it is still true that our churches are black churches or white churches. In Abilene, for instance, the Highland Church, what is it? It is a white congregation, a very good congregation, great people, great history, great ministries, great folk. And what about the Treadway Church? It is a black congregation. Years ago, when I was a student here, a great friend of mine, he was later killed in a car wreck, but Robert English was a member of the Treadway congregation. He was a black young man, a student at ACU, one of the very, very few at that time. Good friend of mine. But when I went there, I went as a visitor. I went as an outsider. If I attended there today, try as I might and want to as much as I might, I still would be in essence, an outsider. We are a racially divided brotherhood. In the city of Houston, we have two weekly preacher's luncheons. You know, if you're talking to a white fella and he's going to the preacher's luncheon, you know which one he's going to. If you're talking to one of our black preachers and he's going to the preacher's luncheon, they'll use the same language. But he's talking about a different meeting. They meet at different times, different places. And there's only a person or two. There are no whites who regularly attend the black preacher's luncheon. There is a black preacher or two who will attend with some frequency the white luncheon. But they are two separate luncheons. We have separate lectureships. Right now there's some concern in Houston, because at least some of us are concerned. I'm a little nervous about what's going to happen, because last fall we had really an impressive soul-winning workshop. You know, they've had them in Tulsa and had them in all sorts of places, and doggone it, we decided to have one in Houston and put together some folk, and they were good organizers, could make things happen. And so October, November, sometime in the fall, we had this workshop in Houston at the Astrodome Sheraton Hotel. And the Astrodome Sheraton is right next to Astroworld and the Astrodome. And so this is one of these awesome hotels. I don't know how many rooms, thousands of rooms. This goes all over the place. These massive ballrooms, and we rented that thing. And we had a workshop, and it was a good one. But it was a white workshop. There were some exceptions. There was a Hispanic track there, and it was fairly successful. There was a black preacher or two, and there were a few black people who attended the meeting. But it was a white workshop, and you know, nobody could really challenge that, I think. And it was successful, and so successful, in fact, that afterwards the evaluation meeting said, "We got to do this again." And somebody said, "When?" And somebody said, "Well, let's don't do it next year. Let's do it 2 years from now." And so it's been scheduled for 2 years from now. Well, shortly after the schedule, I got a letter in the mail from a brother in the Houston area about a crusade for Christ that is planned for the fall of 2 years. And so it created a conflict because the crusade for Christ was not a white brotherhood thing, it's a black brotherhood thing. And so we've got the real possibility now that in the fall of 1999 there are going to be two workshops in Houston. And I think it's entirely possible, given that there aren't but just so many dates that are available, it's certainly possible that they're going to fall on the same date. And I'm not sure that we're big enough or smart enough or that we're Christian enough, if I may be so bold, as to get together and have a workshop. I'm not sure that we're capable of doing that. And so we live these racially divided lives. And we are in fact two brotherhoods, which caused somebody to muse, are we a brotherhood at all, if we are two? If this segregation was biblically defensible, then perhaps it would be a good thing. If we can come up with something in Scripture that makes it possible to defend what we are doing, then I'll back off and to leave you good folk alone, and I'll quit yelling and screaming and making a nuisance out of myself and getting canceled sometimes when I'm scheduled to speak in certain places, and some people get afraid of me, and they call me back and say, well, we had a little change in plans, and maybe you don't need to come after all. If it can be defended biblically, I'll back away and leave everybody alone. The folk, I am convinced that we search in vain for a legitimate biblical principle that will justify the dividing of the church racially. I read that statement because I wanted to be pretty precise. I am convinced that we search in vain for a legitimate biblical principle which will justify the dividing of the church racially. In fact, the teaching of Scripture, in my opinion, is emphatic that Christ makes us one people, and that we are brothers and sisters, and that we ought to live as such within the church. There are a lot of places in the Bible where the biblical principle is true, and I thought this morning about just doing an exposition of a couple of those passages. But I'm not going to do that because I'm certain that I'm talking to some very biblically literate people, that we are not illiterate. We're here at lectureship because we love God and love the Bible. So don't need to do that. But I would refer you to the book of Ephesians. If I was asked to put in one sentence what's the book of Ephesians about, I would say that it is a letter about racial reconciliation. It has to do more than any other single subject, in my opinion, with the breaking down of walls. Jesus came and he destroyed the dividing wall of partition, and he made of us one people. He took the racially divided world into which he came, and he created a family. And Paul, in that letter, in as much as anything else, is saying we ought to live that way. Let me tell you a quick story. I moved to a town 25 years ago to preach, and when we got there, I wasn't a troublemaker, and I stayed there for 16 years, and I loved the folk there, and I think they loved me, and could have probably stayed for a long time. But soon after we got there, I started going out into the community, just inviting people to come to church. I'm a 25-year-old preacher, and I arrive and I'm inviting people to come to church, and it don't make any differences, go around the town inviting folk to church. And we got us a bus. That was what you were supposed to do back then, and so we conformed. We got us a bus, and started roaming around town bringing people to church. Well, some of the people we brought were black, and there had never been any black people in the congregation there. Why should they be? 3 or 4 miles away, there was a black Church of Christ. And why should they come to our church? Well, we started picking them up, and people started coming to our congregation, and we were having a really good time. One Sunday, the elders called me in and said, you can't do that. And I said, I can't do what? He said, you can't bring black people to this church. And I said, I think that I've got on a higher authority. Yes, I can. I've been at this church maybe 3 months, and I've already been called in, and that's the worst thing that happened to a preacher, he gets called in. I got called in, and I'm sitting here in the circle, and these guys are after me, and I actually had an elder in the church say, look, I don't mind if you bring a half a dozen in here, but if I have to start smelling those black bookers, this is an elder in the church. And I said, oh gracious, I'm 25, this is the first place I've ever preached, what am I going to do next? And so what I did next, I got up and preached a sermon on Ephesians 4 one Sunday night. And I said, I took a passage we've always loved, we Church of Christ folk, Chapter 4 says there's, you know, one body, one Lord, one God and Father of us all these things, one baptism. And we've always used that to browbeat the sects. You know, we've slapped the denominations around by saying that there's just one true church. And it's really been kind of a favorite passage of ours. Well, I took it that night and I said, you know, that all may be true, but that's not what this passage is about. Now, what this passage is about is racial reconciliation. There's not one God and one Father and one Lord and one baptism, one body for Jewish people and one for Gentile people. They're just one. And that's, in my opinion, that's what the text is about. So I preached my sermon. Got called in one more time immediately after the service. Had an elder pound on the table and said, I've heard a lot of sermons on Ephesians 4, but I've never heard one like that. Well, you got to understand, I'm 25 years old and brash. And I said, well, you never heard it preached right then. He said, well, he said, you don't see dogs and cats running together, do you? And I had the presence of mind to say, no, sir, but I have sometimes seen black dogs and white dogs together. And so it kind of went downhill. And happily, frankly, and there's no apology, happily, three or four of those elders quickly resigned. It you know, really became loggerheads, and these guys walked away. And frankly, I bade them a fond farewell and said, I hope you'll come back, but come back penitent, because this is sin, and it has to be challenged. And so we challenged it. But anyway, you're a student of the Bible, and you can go and check and see if what I'm telling you is true or not. But I believe the central message, there are many, and it's all focused, by the way, directly on Christ. Ephesians is about Jesus, but it's basically about what he did in reconciling people. And that's what I believe. And so I think that our segregation, though very real and very obvious, is indefensible biblically. And one of the things that makes it doubly tragic, if it was indefensible but it worked, if our system could not be defended but it worked still, then maybe I'd say, well, shoot, let's go on. It's bad, but it's working. But my opinion is, folk, and I'm not going to take the time to make this point. Sometime, I really would love the chance with you or with a broader audience to make this specific point in an entire series of lessons. But I believe that our segregation robs the gospel of power. I base that on a number of passages, but in particular the prayer of Jesus in John 17 when he prays for unity. He says he wants us all to be one, like he and the Father are one, and that's pretty close oneness, in my opinion. I don't think he's excluding us being one with each other, you know, all of us white folk loving each other, and then the black people loving each other. But I just have to believe that he's talking about something broader than that, because Jesus himself said, if you love those who are like you, what? What have you done more than anybody else? I mean, that's not the gospel doing anything. That's human nature. Being close to those who are like you. And so when Jesus in John 17 prays for unity, in verse 23 he makes a profound and amazing statement. He says, let all be one, want them all to be one, that the world may know that you have sent me and that you have loved me as you have loved them. I believe that our racial segregation negates that power. That because we are not one people, the reality, the validity of the incarnation is not enhanced. If we are one people, the world may know that you have sent me. If we're not one people, then perhaps they don't know that. And that you have loved me, loved them as you have loved me. And so, people when they see folk of diverse culture and background and lifestyle, when they see those diverse people loving each other in true brotherhood in the church, that causes an unloved person to think, maybe I can be loved too. So I think that we rob the gospel of great power by our racial segregation. But anyway, my point is, number one, just talking about unresolved issues that concern me, we are a racially segregated brotherhood, which again causes one to muse, are we a brotherhood at all? Number two, we justify our division, and this is where I run afoul of some, you know, great thinkers and committed Christians. We justify our division by, in my opinion, abusing a very well-known principle. It's often called the homogeneous unit principle. And the basic idea, stated simply, is that churches grow fastest and they last longest when their members have most in common. It is a principle that has been expounded more by Donald McGavran than anybody else. Lyle Schaller is an excellent writer and a deep thinker, and he has taken up the cause and preached it as well. McGavran talks about crossing barriers, and he says people don't like to do that. He says people don't like to do that. And when you're trying to preach the gospel and force people to cross barriers, people don't like that. And the point is that if you try to force that, you're going to, he says at great cost to ourselves, we keep the church from growing when we insist on breaking this homogeneous unit principle and building churches that are heterogeneous, made up of all kinds of different people. Well, I think there is certainly legitimacy in their arguments, and I just yesterday and again this morning I read McGavran's book, the section in his book, Understanding Church Growth. I read again his arguments in favor of, or in recognition, he would say, of the homogeneous unit principle, and there is very much there that I very much agree with. But frankly, if I may be permitted to challenge the dean of missions in this century, and that is Donald McGavran, the man to whom people look with greater respect than anybody else, if I may be allowed to challenge him, then I think I'll do that. And if I'm not allowed to, I think I'll do it anyway. Because though the principle is certainly valid in many respects, My conviction is that we have used it, and we have used its broad acceptance to justify that which, in my opinion, is not biblically defensible. I think we have used the principle to make ourselves comfortable with the divisions that exist. Let me tell you quickly about the world I grew up in. And by the way, I grew up 20 miles from where I stand, over in Anson. Born in Hendricks Hospital here in 1945, and I grew up in Anson, Texas. The world that I grew up in was an amazing world as I look back on it. My family was poor. My mother and father, somebody could question why, but they raised 12 children. And they had a one-bedroom house, and there was actually a dirt floor in a part of that house. We were poor people. I think back on those days and what it was like to be poor. And then sometimes I get to thinking, you know, how poor we were and, you know, poor me, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then I wonder, what must it have been like for the black children that grew up in my town? If I suffered a little bit of deprivation on my side of the tracks, what in the world must it have been like on the other side of the tracks? I remember conversations, you know, intellectual conversation among members of the Church of Christ that I grew up being a part of, about whether black people had souls. And I don't think I'm probably the only one in this audience who has heard those kinds of discussions. And you know, frankly, about 50-50. they weren't sure, but there were some who thought, you know, probably so. Probably so. Some of them are pretty good folks. You know, that sort of discussion that went on. When the public schools integrated in 1963 in Anson, there was a kid, and I forgot his name. I wish I could remember it. But he was a phenomenal athlete. You know, black young man, just a great, great athlete. And honestly, and it was to our shame, one of the reasons that integration was accepted is because here's a kid who could play fullback for the football team. And so we brought him on. But my father, my daddy, who I loved and who did a lot better in his later life before he died, but the daddy's lone comment when the schools were integrated is white boys don't play football with mules. And that was supposed to end the conversation. You know, just enough to make you sick. The town was divided by a railroad track. This is Anson, Texas. This is not that many years ago. The town is divided by a railroad track. I went to the white schools, and they were good schools. We had good buildings. We had good materials. We had good teachers, highly qualified teachers, and you know, they equipped us for life in this world. The black kids went to their own school across the railroad tracks in a decrepit old building that I doubt seriously was heated or cooled, or if it was, I'm sure it wasn't cooled. But if it was heated, it was by some sort of an open stove with wood burned in it, maybe some coal. And these kids got the books that we didn't need any longer, and their teachers were less than qualified, and these kids grew up in that environment. They're residuals to that world. And you know what? And it'll be my next point, and I'm trying to race to these points. But there are residuals, and the people who are my age, they don't have my education, and they don't read well, and they don't do math, and their children are still suffering as a result of that world that I grew up in. And so you know, I cringe at that. And the frustrating thing about it is that we have taken the homogeneous unit principle, and we have elevated Donald McGavran and Lyle Schaller and some of these guys, and they deserve it. I'm not trying to lower these guys in the least, because of my respect for them is profound. But we have elevated the principle to the point that we have justified what, in my opinion, is indefensible. You know, again, my opinion, and I told you I was here today to stir the water. And I'm old enough that I don't care what people think. when you're younger, you got to tread the water softly, and you get a certain age, you don't care. You know, you say what you think. And this is what I think. I live now in Houston, and the church I'm a part of, you know, we're trying to recognize the legitimate aspects of this homogeneous unit principle while being faithful to the scriptural demand that we be one people. And I'm not going to take time to do this at length, but let me just show you quickly what we have tried to do. That is the Impact Congregation, and we're all members of it. And then we recognize that basically black people, you know, the cultural things, a lot of times a lot of black folk are bound to a lot of black people, and their lives, their mundane lives, are lived with people who tend to be black. Anglos are the same way. You know, most of our lives are spent with people whom we have a lot of things in common with. Asians and Hispanics. And so in our congregation, we're all members of the same church. And these circles represent the various groups, and we recognize that much of the mundane things, the everyday things, are going to be lived with people who are like us, probably racially. Maybe sometimes it's other things than race that bind us together. But we're trying to be very, very serious about these gray areas where these circles converge, and to have a lot of congregational life that occurs there, where we are one people, and you know, We think it's a good idea, and by the way, after 11 years, we think it's working, and I commend this sort of an approach. But anyway, my second point is, point number one is we are a racially divided brotherhood, which causes me to wonder, are we a brotherhood at all sometimes? Point number two, we justify our divisions by the abuse of the homogeneous unit principle. Number three, just talking about unresolved issues, there are differing perceptions of the nation's and the church's racial history and of current realities that make real unity difficult. White people generally, and I readily confess that these are generalizations, but they're legitimate. White people generally don't realize how deep the feelings of injustice are among most black Americans. Most of us tend to think that black people ought to just get on with it. You know, let's quit this whining and whimpering and belly aching about history and about injustice, and let's just get on with it. And I have some sympathy with that just get on with it philosophy, by the way. I think we can dwell too much on some things. But I do think that until we at least focus on them and have some agreement on them and some understanding of why a lot of blacks have the feelings that they do, that we're ill-equipped to just get on with it. Most white people tend to think that history is just that. It's history, and it has little relevance to today. We think people ought to forget the past and charge on into the future. Black people, on the other hand, believe that this nation's racial history is the source of much of the injustice that they see today. I thought about starting this session this morning by telling you about Kenneth Adams. Kenneth is a kid who grew up in Fourth Ward. He's now 20 years old. But he's been a member of my church. He's been there for 11 years almost. From the very beginning, we found Kenneth. And he lived just off Robin Street in Houston's Fourth Ward. And Houston's Fourth Ward is notorious. It's undergoing rapid redevelopment. And 5 years from now, you're going to be able to walk through a middle-class neighborhood. Tragically, a white one. You know, that's what I predict is going to happen there. But today, I don't recommend you walk through Fourth Ward, period. I just suggest that you really seriously think about that before you do it. And if you do it at noon, and absolutely don't do it in the evening. It's a pretty rough area. One of our young men was shot and killed on the streets of Fourth Ward about 3 years ago. A young man named Michael Harton was selling drugs. And somebody said, well, he got exactly what he deserved. And I come back and I say, I'd sure like you to go to Michael's home sometime with me, and I want you to see the influences that have affected that kid. Kid shot and killed. We've had others brutally beaten. We had one little girl who's got a permanent bracelet. It's a scar bracelet where a rat chewed around her wrist while she slept one night. This is a bad, bad area. Kenneth Adams grew up there, and he is a member of our church. Last night, I prayed for him last night because he's out of school now, and we sought desperately to find work for this young man. And we've got a tutor for him, by the way, that meets with him once a week trying to help him. He's out of school, but he can barely read. And he's very intelligent. He's anything but an unintelligent kid. The system has just choked him to death. But I prayed for him last night because he took a job, and it was an offshore job. He was going to ride a helicopter at 6 o'clock last night. He said, that thing doesn't get over 10 feet above the water. And I'm scared to death. But he was going out for a 2-week job on an oil rig. And he'll come back in a couple of weeks, and we're hoping to goodness that it's a good experience, and we can get him back out on the thing. Again, it's a pretty good job. Pays pretty good. But my point about this young man is that that he is the product of all sorts of sociological forces over which he had no control. He couldn't control anything that happened to him. And there are many, 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 you know, there are Rush Limbaugh types. And I agree with a ton of what Rush Limbaugh says. I most of the time disagree with the intensity with which he says things and with the things that he ignores. But there are types who would say that this young man had just got to be told to take advantage of the opportunities. And while there's some truth to that, the reality is that that there are all sorts of sociological forces. Some of them started in Anson, Texas 50 years ago, 52 years ago when I was born, and he lived in this separated world. This young man is a product of so much that has happened in this nation's history. When white folks say, hey, if you work hard in America today, you can make it, and let's just forget the past, let's get on with the future. A lot of blacks are angered by that because they believe that it fails to recognize the current residual realities of this nation's painful history. And that causes distrust and division even within the church. Because again, here we are saying from our position of power, we're saying, let's just get on with it, let's forget that. And the other guy's saying, here's a 20-year-old kid who can barely read or write, and he can't go to college because he's not equipped for college, though he's certainly intelligent enough to go to anybody's college, if we can get him some background that'll equip him to do it. But he is a residual product of this nation's history. And our failure, You know, our failure to say yes, that's correct, and let's all work together. Let's depoliticize this thing. I have no interest in politics. I have become less political lately than I've ever been in my whole life. I am absolutely not convinced that God is a Republican or a Democrat, and I'm tired of politicizing things. And what I want the church to do is the church to say, yes, these realities exist and they are painful and the residuals are unavoidable. What are we going to do now to help the situation? And my concern is that the black perception is that the white folk would just like to push it under the rug and act like it never happened, our history, and that there are no residuals, that now it is an entirely level playing field. I'm telling you, it's not a level playing field. And much of the failure to find a level field is our failure to embrace realities, historical realities and their current residuals. I want to read you something, and I'm talking really fast because I've got 2 days worth of material and 1 hour to deliver it in. Great American Speeches. Let me read you a few words from A Great American Speech. It's by Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass was an amazing black man back in the last century. He was born into slavery in Maryland, and he escaped, became a famous orator, probably an orator of the same capability of Martin Luther King Jr. Great, great, great speaker, tremendous writer. In 1852, he was invited to make a speech in Rochester, New York, on July the 4th. I'd like to read all the speech. Let me read just a little bit of it. He says, "Fellow citizens, pardon me, allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and natural injustice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence? Would to God, both for your sakes and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions. Then would my task be light and my burdens easy and delightful. For who is there so cold that a nation's sympathy could not warm him? Who so obdurate and dead to the claims of gratitude that would not thankfully acknowledge such priceless benefits? Who so stolid and selfish that would not give his voice to swell the hallelujahs of a nation's jubilee when the chains of servitude had been torn from his limbs? I am not that man. In a case like that, the dumb might eloquently speak and the lame man might leap as a hart. But such is not the state of the case. I say with a sad sense of the disparity between us, I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common." And on he goes. And somebody said, "Why read that?" That was before the Civil War, and slavery still existed. Why read that? And the reason I read that is because white people say, "Why read that?" And black people shake their heads and say, "Wow, what a speech." What a speech. Eddie L. Harris, if you want to read a fascinating book, truly fascinating book, read South of Haunted Dreams by Eddie L. Harris. He's a black man, one of the best writers that I've ever read. I hate bad writing. You know, a guy can have great thoughts, but if he can't write, then I can't read him. You got to write well if I'm going to read him. Eddie Harris is a tremendous writer. One of the best that I know of. He's a black man, and he grew up in a kind of a privileged setting in St. Louis. But when he was grown, he was told stories of his grandfather, a man named Joseph, who was a slave in the Deep South. And he had never been South, but when he got to be 40-something years old, he got a motorcycle and decided to ride into the South and to experience life there. He was angry. He was angry at the residuals that I'm talking about, and he was angry because white people say there are no residuals, everything's hunky-dory, and he says it's anything but that. And he said, "I'm going to ride into the South," and he said, "I'll probably kill somebody or get killed because I'm an angry, angry man." And by the way, it's a good story, and he comes to some happy conclusions at the end. I say happy conclusions that are solid because they're a foundation for standing on and going forward from. But I want to read you just a quick couple of paragraphs as he began the journey. He says, "Forgive me if I rant, but you cannot know." Excuse me. "Forgive me if I rant, but you cannot know how I have cried and despaired and nearly given myself over to the dark gods of bitterness and frustration. You cannot know, unless I now tell you, how the anger often wells up in me lately, and I am driven to the edges of violence and hate, and I want insanely to fight men bigger than myself and burn buildings down, set fire to their homes, their happiness, their way of life. They and I alike pretend not to know whence comes this anger, for it seems in my case to be especially unfounded, to make little sense. I was not born into slavery or into abject circumstance. Luckily for me and for those around me, the gods in whose laps we sit saw fit that I should not be so cursed, for then I surely would have been a murderer, indeed a butcherer. I am not my father, not of my father's generation. I was not tempered in the kiln of Jim Crow. I was instead forged in a new furnace, hammered out of a new tradition, wholly connected to the old, as all tradition must be, but so utterly different. I do not come to the South with hat in hand, head bowed, timid, and humble. I stand tall and firmly planted. I'm not small. I take up plenty of space. I'm proud of who I am and what I am, as arrogant as my father ever was, and I burn with an anger that is rightfully his, but that anger, that is anger nonetheless. And I am afraid, I'm almost certain, in fact, that before this trip ends, someone will die." Again, somebody says, "Why read that?" And the reason I read it is because white people say, "Why read that?" And the black people shake their heads and say, "I understand exactly how he feels." The differing perceptions, our failure to embrace the injustices that are residuals of our painful history is a source of greater division than most of us realize. Louis Farrakhan scares me to death. And what scares me is not him. What scares me is the way his message resonates with black Americans and with a lot of the most reasonable, sweet, gentle-spirited Christian black Americans that I know in the city of Houston. I say to them, "What do you think about Louis Farrakhan?" Expecting them to say, "Man, he's hideous and horrible." And they say, he's got a lot to say. So, we have those differing perceptions, and to me, it's an unresolved issue. Fourthly, trying to move very quickly, there is a problem, and again, I'm willing to fight this one. There is a problem with white arrogance related to what we just said, but white arrogance and abuse of power. And the frustration is, it's not coming from arrogant people. We are not. I said a while ago in the very beginning that I trust us. I have real confidence in us. But we convey an arrogance that we're not aware of most of the time, but that black people are in the church are painfully aware of. Several years ago, you know, wives have a way of zeroing in on problems. We used to have discussions. And I would kind of end the discussion by saying, "Well, you know, I don't think that's right." And I meant that to end the discussion. And she finally pointed out, "Yeah, and you know what? Your problem is that when you say, 'I don't think that's right,' because you're the man, and because in the church we've given you absolute power, wives are supposed to be subject to their husband, the fact that you don't think it ends the discussion." And she says, "What if you're wrong?" So, "Well, I don't think I am." See, that's the problem. That's the problem. Well, something that we don't understand is that we have such power. I'm talking about white Americans and white Christians. We have such power. We have the power of our education, are able to craft a sentence. We have the power of our money. We have the power that is just intrinsic in our society. And even when we're trying to be one people, we tend to be one people with those who are in power dominating. It's evident even at Impact, where I work. We talk about these things, we try so hard, but even in the conduct of our worship assemblies, we tend to have often white suburban style of worship, and you know, we're not comfortable with blending the cultures. And again, as I read Donald McGavran, he would say, well, don't try, because people don't like to cross those barriers, don't try. But then I read Jesus, and he says, yeah, let's be one people, and the world will know that I've been sent, and they'll feel loved. And so I say, well, I shouldn't say this because it's being taped, but frankly, on this subject, I'll take Jesus over McGavran. And I do think that it's that strong. But, you know, we tend to dominate, and it's hard not to do that. But there is another opposite truth. I had a written discussion with Larry James over in Dallas. Larry works with the Inner City Church, or he has worked with the Inner City Church in Dallas, which is similar to the congregation that I work with in the city of Houston. And we had a kind of a fiery discussion last year, because his feelings are as strong as mine, and actually he goes further than I do. And we were having a discussion last year about, what do we do now? You know, if all of the stuff that I've said here this morning is stuff that he and I have talked about, what do we do next? And he says the white church is going to have to repent. That's all. He says that's what we've got to do. And you know, I love and respect Larry, and frankly, I have some pretty profound agreement with that. But I took a position that really ignited him, and he came back at me a little bit, and I appreciated it. But I said, you know, while everything that I've said is true, there's another side to it. And the other side is probably shown as clearly as in any other thing in the current federal welfare programs. We have created a dependent people. We've taken the injustices I've talked about, and we've said the way you correct the injustices is you take away from those who've got and you give it to those who've been deprived, and that creates justice. And what that really does is that creates dependence over here. And so, you know, I said I think that this victim mentality that we have, that a lot of our people have, a lot of black people have, is a tremendously detrimental thing to us ever correcting the problem and making the world a better place. We've got people who said, yeah, the story you told about Anson is true. And Kenneth Adams, a kid who's out on the offshore oil rig today, is the residual product of all that injustice. And while that is true, the solution is challenging people to not just demand that restitution be made, but give people real opportunity and then real support to take advantage of the opportunity. And that this victim mentality is as detrimental as is the other side. The white arrogance that says, hey, it's history, let's forget it, let's get on. That's devilish. So is the attitude that says, you done me wrong, now do me right. Give me stuff. And that is an ongoing problem. And in fact, somebody said, you know, that the Martin Luther King Jr. days, the civil rights days of the 60s, a black man told me, black people were better off then than now. And the reason is that we have actually created a form of slavery for some people that is worse than the real slavery of the last century, because it's a slavery of the mind. And we have created some dependence that is a real, real issue. This victimization mentality that says, take care of me, has created a real, real problem. And so we've got to speak to all that. What are the solutions to all of this? I have proposed two. And they are not very specific, I'm sorry to say. How do you resolve the problem of racial segregation and tension? Within the church, you do it, first of all, intentionally. Somebody called it intentionality. You do it on purpose. You don't sit around waiting for things to correct themselves. You recognize the realities, and you try to solve them. You don't simply pray for solutions, and you don't simply sit around waiting for them to happen. You get involved and try to make things different and better. Secondly, you practice humility. This is also done intentionally. You recognize that what we talked about is real, and you say, I'll give myself to solutions, and I'll do it with real humility. And then you get on with it. By the way, that's what Eddie Harris finally concludes after he rides his motorcycle through the South. Encounters all kinds of folk, and some of them really nice white people. It surprises him. And finally, he says, we do have to just get on with it. We do just have to go on from where we are. But a white fellow saying that considers different realities than a black fellow saying that. So I'm done, and we'll happily respond to any questions anybody's got, or go anywhere you want to go with the discussion.
Would you suggest then that what our congregation is doing right now might be part of the answer?
I don't know what you're doing.
We're rapidly intermarrying. Two of our deacons have white wives. Fine. One of them is a black man. He's my family doctor.
Yeah.
His wife's Vietnamese. She's also Chinese. Our preacher's wife is Chinese. She's also Laotian. We have eight interrelated marriages in our congregation.
Yeah.
And I suspect these people are coming to me. They're destroying the black congregation by leaving. Probably see us as part of the solution.
Yeah.
Well, let's go over there. We've accepted.
You know, Brother Taylor, I
think they're stepping the right direction at least.
Well, you know, I'm certainly not promoting interracial marriage. Yeah, that's not my solution. Let's yeah, but I am promoting acceptance, and you know, if a young couple comes to me and says, we're going to get married, I'm black, she's white, I'm going to say, I have no problem with that, but I do think you need to think real long and hard about what you're doing, because it's going to create some difficulties and complication. And frankly, those of us that have been married a long time know that marriage is difficult under the best of circumstances. Martin?
You know, it strikes me that some of the things you have described here are not even an exact parallel, but taking back to the New Testament world, the tensions that existed between the Jews and the Gentiles, you see so much written in the New Testament about that, that there are some parallels there between them, some of the places where it's addressed. And that's why I think so much of the New Testament is written in terms of trying to get the two groups together and build those two groups yet together.
Well, obviously, I absolutely agree.
Civic application, we had 34 staff troops here, and we got a staff marriage for a Spanish boy staff troop 7 years, so all kinds of new stuff coming through that.
Yes, sir.
I'm from Brownsville, Texas, and I'd like your insight on bilingual education and the problems we're facing with language.
Oh, gracious. I don't know. I mean, I've listened to and read the arguments, and you know, in speaking of bilingual education in specific, in Houston, we have got we got 250 actually Spanish speaking people at our congregation. None of these people have Church of Christ backgrounds, which gives us a fascinating pool of resource to glean some thinking. And you know, I think that given the realities of the world we live in, the fact that there are now 1 million plus Hispanics in Houston, San Antonio's got the same sort of situation, and the population is growing so rapidly, To me, it seems that bilingual education makes all the sense in the world, that that's the world we live in. The Hispanic people in my congregation disagree with me more than anybody else. I have got Hispanics from Nicaragua and Costa Rica and all sorts of places who do not want their children, in some cases, even learning to speak Spanish. And they say that if they do, that, you know, there's so many things that I hear. One is that very few people are truly fluent in two languages. You know, there's fluency, and then there's real fluency, which appreciates all the nuances of language and allows you to have really deep conversations. And I'm not bilingual. I've taken 50 private Spanish lessons, and I can muddle along a little bit. But some of you guys are truly bilingual. But what I hear is that most people who have a first language, a second one, is they're not as competent in that language. We had a young man from Houston who grew up near our church building, went all of his life practically to our congregation, got out of high school, and he was making really good grades in this inner city school. He came to ACU, and he spoke Spanish as a first language, and we thought he was quite fluent in English. The reality was that when he got to college level, he absolutely could not perform. You know, the classes went too fast, the teachers talked too fast, they said too much, they asked him to read too much. And this kid came, and he had made 98s on his report card the last year of his school in inner city Houston. And he got here, and I don't think he passed anything. He just couldn't do it. And some of the people there reasoned that the reason he could not is because we allowed him to be bilingual, and because he was bilingual, he never really developed proficiency in English. And so, I don't know. What do you think?
My dream is that, and this kind of goes against some of the things you said, I know that prevalent opinion is among many people that we can't speak two languages, and I certainly struggle with Spanish. I lived in Argentina for 6 years, too, and I question whether or not I'm fluent yet. Some people say I am, but I really question it. But my dream would be that we, since we're a global world, that we could learn both languages well and the kids could go and speak.
Well, again, that's what I think. And the greatest opposition I find is from Hispanics, you know, in my immediate circle of Christian people. We Anglo fellas say, let's all learn both languages.
But I will say this, we do have, my opinion is that most of our kids in schools down there cannot speak either language or write any language very well.
Yeah. But basically, if somebody just asked me, ideally, give me bilingual, because that's the world we live in.
Good job. I suggest to you, check up on this guy, Jose Armas, a well-known syndicated Hispanic writer. He is violently opposed to bilingualism. He writes in the Albuquerque Journal about every week, and about 50 people a week are mad enough to shoot him. But he's opposed to it. I was here in a family where nobody spoke English. You don't be a fool all your life. That's his thing.
So when you put it into the schools, I don't know. Should we all be bilingual? Absolutely. It embarrasses me that we're not.
Yeah.
Hispanic kid comes to this country, and 6 months later he speaks English. And we live around Hispanic folk for 52 years, and we still don't speak Spanish. I don't think it speaks well of us.
We live in Albania. Many of our students speak English, Italian, Albanian. Maybe Russian.
And speak them well.
Yeah. Four or five different languages.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My wife is struggling trying to learn Albanian. I'm not trying to learn. It's very hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Folk, I appreciate you coming in very much. And y'all defend me if somebody attacks me from this table.